Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What fuels human ingenuity and artistry? While a need for self-expression seems to be almost universal, no two artists, and indeed no two people, take exactly the same path to illumination. Julie Burstein has spent much of her career exploring the passions and processes of artists, which can serve as a source of inspiration even to those of us who work outside the arts. Burstein created PRI's Studio 360 and headed the show's creative team for 9 years. She shares some of her favorite examples in her new book, Spark: How Creativity Works, and she's in town to speak tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art to Arts and Letters Live. Julie, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
When you first started this book, did it feel like an entirely different idea for exploring the arts than when you started Studio 360?
What I tried to do was make it similar enough because I was entering a whole new medium. I'd worked in radio for a long, long time. And at the beginning of Studio 360, we did what we called looking at where art and real life collide.
Yeah.
And so that was something that I wanted to kind of look through all of the interviews that we'd done for the stories that made that collision and connection come to life. But I realized writing a book is really different from making a radio program. And one of the things I realized is here in radio, we have this incredible gift, which is people's voices. Mm-hmm. And so one of the biggest challenges was, how do you convey the emotion that's behind people's stories that come to life immediately on the radio? But I realized I'm going to have to describe things in a really different way in print.
Did you find yourself writing each person, you know, as you started sort of hearing their voice in your head, even as you were writing in your own words about them?
Yes. And I really started the way that I've always made radio, too, from the tape. Mm-hmm. So I had everything transcribed, which we hadn't done in Studio 360. We just worked off of rough logs. And then tried to bring the person to life through the things, through their voice, through the way that they speak on the page, so that you can hear William Christenberry, who's from the South. There are these rhythms to his language that are different, say, than Chuck Close, who's from Washington State.
I want to talk about Chuck Close, because here is a guy, he's a visual artist, people may know his work, they may not know his story. It seems as if every obstacle you could throw at a human being to get in the way of creating art, or to give him or her an excuse not to produce art, has been thrown at Chuck Close.
Maybe even not to produce life. He says that he grew up in the 40s and 50s, and he said, in those days, no one knew from learning disabilities. I was just dumb.
Let's listen to him talk a little bit about that.
I think I learned early on that since I also wasn't athletic and I couldn't run or catch a ball or throw a ball, that I needed to do something to keep people around me. So I began doing magic acts and puppet shows, and I began to realize that one of the things that I could do that my friends couldn't do was draw. And I was lucky enough to have the support of my family and to feel like I had something to say, even though I didn't say it in the traditional way. I was learning disabled, although in the 40s and 50s, nobody knew from learning disabilities. I was just dumb.
That's one of the most powerful things I think I've heard on Studio 360, partly because as a parent, one of my kids has learning disabilities. And I know I often just felt so despondent because, you know, will he be able to grow into who he is? And one of the things that I found in re-looking at these interviews is people like Chuck Close or Richard Ford, the novelist, who was also severely dyslexic, for them, it wasn't just that they had to face their disabilities and conquer them. They actually informed who they became mm-hmm. as artists. So for Chuck Close, he's learned how to understand how to make art through wrestling with his own learning disability. And part of that is understanding the whole. And the way he can do that is by looking at small parts of things.
Yeah, one of the ways that Close's learning disability really informs his work is that he has a condition that I will just use the shorthand sort of layperson's term, face blindness. He has trouble recognizing the faces of even people he knows quite intimately.
Yes, he does. If you were to have a conversation with Chuck Close, a very nice conversation, and he saw you the next day, he would not recognize you because I think it's prosopagnosia, which is face blindness. It is a disability where you cannot recognize faces in three dimensions. All of his work is portraiture. And at the beginning, he just painted friends and family. And he says part of it was to be able to imprint their faces on his memory.
It's remarkable because he's known for portraits that also, you know, there are, I guess when he's trying to deal with this, he looks very closely at, say, what someone's nose looks like and maybe focuses on that to remind him later on.
Yes, and he also, he puts a grid over the image. He works from photographs, so he'll take a photograph. At first, it was just photographs of himself, and then he puts a grid over that, and that's how he then can, he says, build a painting.
And one of the things he talked about on Studio 360 was visiting some mosaics.
I was recently living in Rome, and I was looking at the humble Roman floor mosaics, and there, the viewing distance is the height of the viewer. You look down at the floor. And there is a floor made up of chunks of stone. And just when you get used to looking at the chunks of stone on that flat surface, it warps into an animal or a head or whatever. And just when you're comfortable looking at the animal or head, it flattens back out and insists on being seen as a flat floor made up chunks of stone. And the wonderful thing is that across the centuries, it's as if I'm looking over the shoulder of the artisan who made that floor, and I can see the record of the thought process that he used, where he chipped a little corner off the stone and nudged it in, and three or four or five or six of those stones become a piece of a face or an eyeball or something. It's something that you instantly, the viewer can instantly understand as a process.
I was just over at the Dallas Museum of Art this morning and looking at a couple of their mosaics and thinking, he's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And it is wonderful to think of art as a process. And one of the other things that we had on Studio 360 years ago is a scientist who was actually in a museum and he saw Chuck Close. And this is a scientist who studies perception. And he suddenly realized that Chuck Close had figured something out that the scientists hadn't, about the way the eye perceives shapes and the sort of focal distance you need to be able to turn a bunch, as Chuck Close says, a bunch of just little stones into a face. And this scientist went on to publish papers growing from Chuck Close's work that look at how our eye perceives shapes and is able to take little pieces of information and create a whole. So I loved that kind of going back and forth between this guy who had this serious learning disability and couldn't understand the whole, to a man who creates these extraordinary portraits who then informs science about the way we perceive the world.
And then about 15 years ago, he suffered a spinal aneurysm.
He did. He did. And he became almost completely disabled. And some of his friends say that what saved him was work itself, that was really how he came back to life. And he's had to develop new ways of holding brushes because his hands can't hold brushes. Initially, he just taped them to his wrists. But in the facility where he was rehabilitated, they were astonished because he started painting before anybody imagined he might. And now he creates still these extraordinary works.
I think it's always interesting when artists talk about it's a drive. It's not even a choice. For some people, it feels like a great effort every time they set down to work. But in his case, it's not something he almost chooses to do. He has to do it to survive.
And he also has this wonderful phrase that inspiration is for amateurs and the rest of us just get to work. And I think that exactly. He needs the work to organize his life, and he needs to be able to express what he sees. And so when he had this great tragedy in his life, he used work to propel him forward. And that's another thing that I've seen throughout the stories in Spark. There's a sense that there are these things that happen to us that most of us back way far away from. Mm-hmm. But in order to really create a way that creativity works is by going towards it and embracing it. And that work itself, creating rituals around the work that you do, can often be the thing that sees you through great tragedy like disability or the death of a loved one. I mean, art does this for us too. Thank goodness these artists do it for us and we can look over their shoulders. But hearing the artists talk about the road they took to make their work is really powerful.
One of the rituals that comes out in the book here is from the novelist Isabel Allende, who we've had on the show before, and famously starts every book on the same day.
Yes, she starts every book on January 8th, which is the day she began what she thought was a letter to her grandfather who was dying. And she started this letter. She was living in exile, And it turned into the House of the Spirit. So now every January 8th, she starts a new book.
I haven't finished the one that I started this year, but I'm going to start another book all the same, because if I don't start on January 8th, I will probably not write it. I want to start something and then finish what I'm doing and then go back to the book that I will start next year. But I'm still doubting about what that book will be about. Can you imagine what January 7th is like in my life?
I loved that comment. And I think that idea, you know, work is hard for all of us, but it also is a source of so much pleasure. And there are artists who have created rituals for themselves that allow them to do this hard work of creating something out of nothing. Having a ritual of the day you start is one. Joyce Carol Oates talks about how what she needs to do before she can actually start writing is dreaming, and that she spends most of her time dreaming, and then the work is putting a language to that mm-hmm. dream. So there, as you said at the beginning, and I loved hearing you say it, there's so many different ways of approaching this idea of how do you become more creative.
What's fascinating about the rituals that you talk about is in most cases, the artists are aware that these are almost, they're just shy of superstition. They don't really believe they have magical powers. It's Isabel Allende doesn't think that January 8th is this only day she can start, but it's about discipline.
Absolutely.
And it's funny that we don't talk nearly as much about artistic discipline as about the flash of genius that most working artists and most working scientists will tell you is kind of a myth.
Well, I think that flash of genius is there, but it's the preparation up and to that point
yeah.
that we don't talk about. And I think that that's exactly right. I mean, that's why Chuck Close says, if you just wait for the bolt of lightning, you'll be waiting for the rest of your life. But if you sit down and just start working, something will come to you. It's interesting, though, too, in that there's the idea of it as work. And then Richard Serra, the sculptor, talks about it as play, that he thought he was going to be a painter. But he went to Europe and he saw Velázquez's Las Meninas and he thought, I can't do that. And he threw all of his brushes into the river and into the Arno and said, I think I'm just going to play. And he's just spent a lot of time saying, what could I do with this? And trying all kinds of different ways of playing with his material. And that was his process, was saying, I don't care what it's going to end up like. I'm just going to try a lot of different things.
And that seems like something that most of us have a hard time getting beyond. It's so hard to not really pay attention to what the final product is and not think of work as a means to an end.
I know that was so totally true for me. I write in the book about my own process and that I was this incredible procrastinator. And it was only when two things happened to me in college. I took pottery, where if you make something, you can then completely squish it back up and start again. Mm-hmm. And so the idea that, oh, it doesn't have to be perfect because I can just make a new one was huge. And the other was radio, which is so deadline driven that you can't worry about something being perfect because you just have to keep going. And if you're supposed to be on the air at 6 o'clock at night, you're on the air at 6 o'clock at night, whether you're ready or not. So I think having both of those things, the understanding that nothing is perfect and nothing is finished and you can just keep going with it, that can be dangerous too because you can keep going forever. So then having a deadline and saying, okay, it's got to be done by X point and then I move on to the next thing. Both of those things are really helpful.
My guest is Studio 360 creator Julie Burstein. Her new book is called Spark, How Creativity Works. She's in town to speak tonight to the Dallas Museum of Art's Arts and Letters Live series. You can find information about that at dm-art.org or on the think page of kera.org. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Julie Burstein, creator of PRI's Studio 360 and author of the new book Spark, How Creativity Works. She's in town for the Dallas Museum of Arts Arts and Letters live event this evening. You can find information about that on the Think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@KERA.org or call 1-800-933-5372. I'm curious, Julie, if you've got a perspective on what you can know about someone you're going to write about or interview or collect information about ahead of time and what you can't possibly know until the moment that you sit down with them.
Well, I love exactly that juxtaposition because when we do interviews on Studio 360, when I do interviews, and I think when you do interviews, you try to bring in as many different points of view on the person you're going to talk to as you can so you get a sense of who they are. But I know for me, the parts that are exhilarating are when something happens that's utterly surprising. And suddenly I find something out, like with Chuck Close, about the way that he builds his paintings that I hadn't known before because I hadn't ever heard him talk about it before. Or Richard Serra, who talks in Spark about another ritual, which is what happens when you get stuck.
Right.
And in this interview, he just starts talking about the days when he was a young sculptor working in New York City with Philip Glass as his assistant. And Phil Glass was actually working as a plumber at that time and writing music. And every day around 4 o'clock, they would just lose steam and completely get stuck. And Sarah said, so what we did was every day we would just go out on the ferry and just go out and get away from our problem, which I think is also something so important to creativity, is when you're at a point where you can't go any further, just let it go, walk away, fill yourself up with something outside, whether it's, you know, walking through the streets of your city or, as he did, getting on the ferry and looking at the Statue of Liberty, just getting other input and then come back to your work filled up. But at the end of that story, he said to Kurt, funny, I hadn't thought about that in a long time. I don't think I've ever told that story before. And it's those moments that I just love.
Yeah. The other thing about that particular story is that it reminds us that, you know, I think outside the art world, we tend to think of people as either being bona fide artists or being sort of wannabes who are working as a plumber. And Philip Glass tells the story about he was someone's plumber who had seen a concert of his work the night before and suddenly realized and asked, like, what are you doing fixing my sink? You're an artist, you know, but people sometimes have to do both in order even to make everything work for them and to get to the place where they're really fully creative.
Absolutely. And I think there's the flip side of that, too, is that a lot of people say, oh, well, I'm not creative. I have a dear friend who's a pulmonologist, and she often says to me, oh, I'm not creative. And then I say, well, when you meet a new patient for the first time, what do? She works in ICU units in inner cities. She said, well, I have to assess all of these things, and then I have to think. And I said, that's creative, too. The way that you approach a problem takes all of the information that you know, but has to put it together with new information, too. And just working through a problem like that is a creative act.
Did you anticipate that when you started the series? Did you know that everyone would be able to relate to the work of artists?
No, I knew that there are a lot of people who say they don't think they relate to the work of artists. And so when we started Studio 360, I looked for that connection that all of us might have, which I believe is through life. And that's the thing about these artists. They all grew up somewhere, have families or not. They wrestle with the same kinds of challenges that the rest of us do in our lives. And that's a way for someone who thinks, oh, I'm not interested in contemporary art, to say, oh, Chuck Close had a learning disability. Mm-hmm. My kid has a learning disability. This is interesting. So that is, I also think these artists show us things about our own lives that they're brave enough to stand in what the educator Parker Palmer calls the tragic gap. I don't know whether you know his work, but he says it's not tragic sad. It's tragic inevitable. It's the place between where the world is right now with all of the tragedy and sadness and what we hope it might be. And that's what we look to artists for. And that's something we can all relate to because we're all going to have to deal with these things, with loss and death. And that, thank goodness, there are artists who will look at that for us.
I love the chapter about the poet Donald Hall, who really takes something that most people would imagine is the very worst thing that could happen to someone, and feels every, we should say his wife, the poet Jane Kenyon,
yes,
died at a very young age of leukemia. They had been very close. They worked together. They lived together. They were very passionate.
And she was much younger than he was, and he had nearly died and thought.
They both thought he would die first.
He would die first, mm-hmm, right.
Talk a little bit about his sort of approach. He wrote during the time she was ill, after she was ill. It sort of kept going all along.
It did, and I think it really, like we were talking about Chuck Close, it saved him. The act of work really saved him, this work that he'd been doing since he was a little boy.
I have no difficulty reading them aloud. They have become poems. They start out as screams of pain, and as I work on them, they will come to be something outside me. It is as if I were working with hacking away at a piece of stone to make sculpture or modeling or trying to paint, adding a little paintbrush here and there, adding a little dash of this and that, so that they become works of art. They become a work of art in the art that I love, that I've tried to practice since I was 12 years old. Then they are objectified. They're out there. They start from the pain. They start from the anguish, these poems do. And then they become something that means to be in itself as language, as sound, as imagery, objects of pleasure, objects that give pleasure.
He talks also about how that's one of the central paradoxes of poetry forever, is that you take these screams and turn them into something that's beautiful. And art does that too. He also has this wonderful story about the days right after her death, where he would say to his dog, "Poetry Man is suiting up," because those were the 2 hours of pleasure he had every day, and it brought him close to her.
My late wife, Jane Kenyon, the poet, was a gardener of great passion. And she died in April. The flowers started to come up. They're still coming up in diminished form. I wrote the poem, Her Garden. I let her garden go. Let it go, let it go. How can I watch the hummingbird hover to sip with its beak's tip the purple bee balm, whirring as we heard it years ago? The weeds rise rank and thick. Let it go, let it go. Where annuals grew and burdock grows, where standing she at once could see the peony, the lily, and the rose rise over brick she'd laid in patterns, moss. Let it go, let it go. Turns the bricks green, softening them by the gray rocks where hollyhocks that lofted while she lived, stem by tall stem, dwindle in loss.
You know what I love about that is that we think, some people will think of radio as this sort of quaint medium. And when you hear that, and I loved it in the book, but
I've got
hearing
chills.
It, I know, there's something about the sound of the human voice that you can't replace with bells and whistles and with sort of interactive digital things. It's really a wonderful, wonderful experience just to listen to him read that.
Well, isn't it our first experience? I mean, that, if you think about it, that's our first connection, is through the sounds of our parents' voices.
Even in the womb.
In the womb, exactly. And so that was, as I said at the beginning, one of the challenges of writing is that, thank goodness, Donald Hall is so eloquent that when you read him on the page, he still carries. Mm-hmm. But to hear him read that poem, there is a visceral response. I mean, I literally get chills when I listen to him.
You must have, over the years, also dealt with artists who were not so articulate.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think of, I produced a radio series for Carnegie Hall for many, many years, and I remember prepping the host for an interview with the conductor, and he asked the conductor a question, and the conductor said, "I am conductor. I am not a literary scholar." You know, it's just like, okay. And I remember once
question two.
Exactly. Asking a composer who had just written a book a question, and he said, "Didn't you read my book? It was in my book." So, yes, there are people who make our jobs a little more complicated. And then there are people like Donald Hall who make it so rich.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Julie Burstein is here. She's creator of PRI's Studio 360 and author of the new book, Spark, How Creativity Works. Let's go on the phones to John in Irving. Hello, John.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
I wanted to thank the creator of Studio 360 because that is how I got my 15 minutes of fame. I was on your program. The first time was in November 2009. I was part of a hour-long program about Darwin and evolution.
Oh, yes.
And my segment was about the American Museum of God.
Yes, yes, I remember that.
And the young lady who did that program, Lindsay Patterson from Austin.
Yes.
She came up here, and she had never done a segment like that before, but I took her to the Sulphur River in North Texas, and we went fossil hunting, and I showed her my Museum of God, you know, all the found objects I had found over 40 years in creek beds and river bottoms and in the woods, and how I tried to showcase the nature and character of God with these artifacts. And so she showcased that very, very well. And I was really surprised that they aired that segment several times later.
Yes, we often do work on science and creativity, and that's a fascinating juncture for me also, is that idea that creativity is something that is essential to a scientist's work. Because as you said earlier, you know, that people talk about the aha moment, but there's a lot that leads up to that moment. And so that's something that the show does quite often, is look at where is that intersection between science and creativity.
There's also that fascinating parallel in that no scientist and no artist emerges in a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
Even the things that seem the most novel, there are other people sort of moving in the same direction who may not reach the finish line at the same time.
Yes, and that there are things in the ether that artists may pick up on. I mean, I think that is one of the most important pieces for me in reading Spark again, is how many artists talk about being open to the experience that's going on around them. And that's essential for creativity, is it's not just being monomaniacal and following your vision, but it's also picking up on what's happening in the culture around you so that you understand where you are and who you are. And you've got some fertile ground to work from.
Are most of the artists you work with as open to the idea of ceding control to producers and interviewers and editors and people who will take their stories and what they have said and make them into a finished product that they don't control?
There were some people who said no, actually. There were some artists who I wanted to quote in the book who, for one reason or another, said, I'm not comfortable with that. But most, I think, are happy, because for artists, I mean, I think that's true for all of us, we want to be heard and we want our work to be received and acknowledged. And this is really a way for people to reach a new audience.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to John in Fort Worth. Hi, John.
Hi, how are y'all today?
Great, thanks.
My question is, I oftentimes have a discussion with friends that there are so many great artists and people who have achieved so many great successes and masterpieces in art that have been fueled by addiction and drug use. My question is, would the creativity exist in so many of these wonderful people without the addiction of the drug use? For instance, Miles Davis, the Kind of Blue album, would that have still happened if it wasn't fueled by the addiction?
That is an excellent question, and it's one that we've tackled in a variety of different ways on Studio 360. And I think, again, each artist has their own take on this. I know William Styron has written a lot about his depression. There are other artists. We had Eric Bogosian on. We had a whole show about drugs and how that affects creativity. And I know there are scientists who are looking at this as well. And there are some artists who say, take that away and I'm not going to be as creative. And there are other artists who've been able to face the things that underlie their addiction and come to terms with that, who say, the addiction was not what fueled my creativity and I had to get through it to be able to create. So I think, again, it's all individual stories.
And there's also that question of whether, you know, drug addiction is about self-medication for something else.
Yes,
that's going on.
Exactly. And I think for many people, like William Styron, it was severe depression. And so I think that there are as many answers as there are artists and all of us. But I think one of the things these artists show in Spark is really embracing the challenge rather than running away from it, whether it's it's depression or a disability is the only way to be able to figure out where you're going creatively.
Julie, I thought one of the most charming profiles in the book was of someone I had not, I suppose I'd seen his name, but wasn't aware of it. And that's Ben Burt, the sound designer. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Yes, absolutely. He was someone that one of the Studio 360 team said, we have got to interview this guy because he has created the most iconic sound effects of our generation. And Ben Burt was a student at USC when a guy named George Lucas came up to him and said, hey, I'm about to make a movie. Would you do the sound for it? And that movie, of course, became Star Wars. And Ben Burt said one of the first things that Lucas asked him to do was make the sound of a lightsaber. And he was just playing around in his living room one day with a microphone with a broken cable and heard the buzz of a TV set and thought, that's interesting. And he combined that with the hum of a projector because he had been working as a projectionist at USC. And the two things together became the sound of a lightsaber. And then he played with it with Doppler effect because to make something move, you have to change the way it sounds, whether you're close to it or far away. One of the things I loved about writing about Ben Burt is he is completely dedicated to taking real live sound and transforming it to create these new worlds for us. And he feels really strongly, even in a day when you could create pretty much anything by a computer, if it has its roots in the sound of a little shaving brush in his bathroom or a plucked harpsichord string, we will respond to it as something real, even if it's on Tatooine. So his story is quite wonderful.
Yeah, I just love the idea of going through life, collecting these sounds, and some of them may be useful ultimately, and some of them may sit in sort of recorded, frozen in time, recorded and never be used again, but he's always listening for something.
He is. He's always open. Again, that idea of openness and taking things in. And for him, that's essential to his art because that's where he gets his raw material is from the sounds of whatever. You know, he said the sound of wind can be made by dragging a heavy bag across the floor.
Julie Burstein is my guest. She is creator of Studio 360 and author of the new book Spark, How Creativity Works. She's in town to speak tonight at the Dallas Museum of Art's Arts and Letters Live series. You can find information about that at dm-art.org or on the think page of kera.org. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also join us via email at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults, dedicated to enriching lives for 55 years. How about enriching yours? You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Julie Burstein. She created PRI's Studio 360 and has just written a new book called Spark, How Creativity Works. She's in town to speak to the DMA's Arts and Letters Live series this evening. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 for this conversation. We'll go next on the phones to Ken in Plano. Hello, Ken.
Yes, hi. I was wondering if you could talk about the phenomena known as the child prodigy. You know, the difference between creativity expressed and channeled by a child as opposed to an adult. They seem to make great musicians, but playwrights and poets, not so much. Thank you very much.
That's a really interesting question. And I think, you know, in Spark, there are a couple of artists who we could say were child prodigies. I would say Chuck Close may have been one of those, where he just was this extraordinary artist at a very young age, but had wrestled with things in other aspects of his life. In Studio 360, we've had a couple of shows looking at exactly that. And it does seem that musical facility is one of those things that, you know, I think about Mozart. It was just sort of innate in him and needed to be channeled. But other things, as you talk about, can need to be developed more. And perhaps because language is something that comes later to us than music does. it's a little harder to grasp and to work with. But there are some people who have written extraordinary things at very young ages.
It was interesting to read Patti LuPone talking about her relationship to her own stage mother in taking on the role of Mama Rose in Gypsy.
Yes, and she talks about how she knew by the time she was four that she had this big Broadway voice, and that's what she wanted to do. And her mom was willing to take her from audition to performance, and yet there was a real tension in that relationship. And I think tension and conflict is another thing that underlies a lot of creative work. And so for Patti LuPone, the tension was with her mother, and she used that to fuel her performance of Mama Rose. But there are other artists, like the playwright Tony Kushner, who talks about writing the final number in his musical, Caroliner Change. Everybody knew that one piece, the 11 o'clock number, the big number, wasn't working. And they had this huge screaming meltdown. And then he went off and he wrote something and brought it to the composer, and it was set to music immediately. This was like version 12 or 17 of this song. And when they performed it, the audience went nuts. It was the end of the previews. But what Tony Kushner says in Spark is, we're really proud of the outcome, but the struggle is something we're just as proud of, that we couldn't have gotten to that last version if we hadn't gone through all 17 versions and all of the fights to be able to get there. And I think that's another key to how creativity works, is understanding that conflict can move you forward, that it's often the growing edge of your work. That, and I think that this is true in business and in, I know in my creative work as leading a team of producers, I had to keep an eye out for where the friction was, because often that was where something new was going to happen. And if I paid attention to it in one way and said, oh, you guys stop fighting, or if I paid attention to it another way and said, what's going on here and where's the conflict, suddenly we might be able to move to something new.
And you'll never move to something new if you say, no, we've always done it this way and it works fine.
Right, right. No, then you do the old things, and sometimes that's fine. Mm-hmm. You know, continuing to do the old thing over and over and over again. But to be an artist, you have to move towards that thing that's new.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Bruce in Dallas. Hi, Bruce.
Good afternoon. I'm an architect, and I noticed your comment about talking about the nurse and reminding everybody that we all have that creative side to us. One thing that helped me in architecture school, one of the professors shared the fact that oftentimes we're in the creative process, we get stymied, and it's because the fact that the brain is either in the analytical or the creative phase and can go back and forth rapidly between the two. And sometimes we're assuming we're always in one side or the other. And sometimes to get out of that stymied position when we are stalemated, it helps to understand which side is keeping us from moving forward in that creative process. Have we not done enough analytical to be able to move forward in the creative, or we haven't finished doing enough creative? But you get the point.
It's and that's very interesting.
So it's oftentimes, I know, you sit there and you look at the sheet of paper and you can't get either one started writing on a script or a book or a software program or a design for a sculpture or art.
I think we've got your point, Bruce, and I think it's a really interesting one.
I think that is interesting when it gets to the idea of conflict, and that's in a sense internal conflict and the tension between the images you may have in your head and how do you actually get them out on the paper. And I think that is a wonderful way of explaining it, that we've got various ways of approaching a problem and we need all of those in order to be able to move through it.
The other thing about creative people is that unlike someone who, you know, works in a factory, tomorrow they know they're going to have to make 1,000 widgets. They know what the widgets are going to look like. If you're a creative person, you don't know what's coming next necessarily.
Or you might, like Chuck Close, create a structure for yourself where you do know most of what's coming next, but you play with that little bit that's left that's not known. He says, I wanted to do tomorrow what I did today, and he wanted to have a process that would allow him to just lay everything out. But within that path, he has infinite opportunities. So I think that both are necessary, the structure and the flights of imagination.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. My guest is Julie Burstein, author of Spark, How Creativity Works. Let's go next to John in Fort Worth. Hello, John.
Hi, how are you today?
Great, thanks.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for taking my call. And I have to say, you're by far one of the best shows on here at KERA.
Thank you.
I look forward to it every day.
Thanks.
So coming from an artistic family and being surrounded by people in that mindset and having gone through art school myself, I've kind of always wondered if, as a chicken or egg type question, whether or not our imagination feeds our creativity, or if perhaps our inherent creativity feeds our imagination. Because I feel like I have a very vivid imagination, and I wonder which is feeding what.
Oh, how interesting. Well, I have to say, I probably don't have the right answer to that, but what it makes me think about is something that a lot of these artists talk about, is that you need both to kind of be in your own head and thinking about things, and you also need to go out and fill yourself up, so that creativity comes from within and has that discipline in it. But everybody talks about seeing something, hearing something, having an experience that sparked something in them to move them to create. So I think you need both. I don't think, I guess it's that chicken and egg question. I'm not sure we can ever answer that.
Well, I want to talk about this. You know, we've spent a reasonable amount of time on this show and probably in other places in public radio lamenting the lack of arts education in schools. But let's set that aside for a minute and say that a lot of people can agree there ought to be more. What have you learned about what constitutes really effective arts education?
You know, I'm not sure I'm the best person to talk about arts education, in that for me, I was just lucky growing up that my parents took me to see exhibits and I had an opportunity to play the cello. And for me, art was something that I just loved to do. I would say if I were to advocate anything, it's getting the chance to make things, because I think that's different than looking at things. You need both, but the opportunity to actually make something, as Richard Serra says, without worrying about the outcome. I was just over at the Dallas Museum of Art and saw a bunch of school kids walking around. There was some great interactions with docents, one of whom had a group of preschoolers, and saying, "What shapes do you see?" And the kids got all excited. And then I went in to the place where you can actually make art, and there was a mom with her two kids playing with paper clips and string and whatever else. And I think that you need both of those things to be able to look at things and understand what you're looking at, and then just to play and have a lot of fun with creating something.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Sandy in Dallas. Hi, Sandy.
Oh, hello. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Oh, I'm a first-time caller.
Welcome.
And thank you. And I'm listening to the program, and how true. I'm listening to what you're saying, and I agree. And sometimes out of tragedy, my creative spirit has wanted to come out. I had three losses in 2008 and one in 2009. Mm. And since then, my creative spirit has wanted to just come out of me.
Mm.
And I took a singing class, and my goodness, and we performed, and I could not believe how proud I was of myself to get up and sing.
How
it
wonderful.
It was just the most, oh, wow, I just couldn't believe it. It was so incredible, the energy, positivity, and it even helped to reduce my stress level.
That's wonderful.
That's the best endorsement you could possibly imagine.
I love that. And I think that I know for me, the urge to make things, even if they're things that nobody else will see, can sometimes be so powerful. And also singing, it sounds like you may be singing with a group. Singing in a group of people, there's something about that energy that's just so extraordinary.
Well, there's no better sound experience than being right in the middle of, you know, 20 other people around you singing.
Yes, yes. And I think, I don't know whether scientists have studied this, I should look into it, but I think there's also a physical experience of having the music around you like that, that probably does make changes in who you are and how you see the world.
Does writing a book require a different kind of creativity from you than preparing a radio program?
Absolutely. I think when I decided that I would write this book, I was really scared because I've spent years and years working with these amazing creative teams and having a group of talented producers around so that if someone throws out an idea, 12 other people will then respond and suddenly you're in a new space. And writing a book meant going into my tiny little office in my attic in my home and spending hours and hours with transcripts and my own head. And I was very scared of that, but I found myself loving it. It's a very different process, but it was so satisfying. It also was tough. And I think one of the things I've learned both in radio and in writing is that there's always a moment where I think, this story is not going to work. I need three other artists. I'm never going to get through this. And what I learned was that's a part of my creativity, is that I always get to a point where I think, this is terrible. And it's usually the next morning where I'll wake up and think, oh, that's because I have to do this, this, and this, and connect these things, and suddenly I see where things are going. That's always been true for me in radio, and it was true in the book. And just recognizing that was so useful, because instead of being so depressed when it happened, I thought, oh, okay, that's that stage, and I'm sure I'll get through it. So,
yeah, it is interesting, all that research about what happens in the brain while we sleep. And we might think our bodies are just resting, but there are connections that are made that can't happen if we don't sort of check out from the world and fall asleep for a few hours.
Yeah, and I think that is – it's so hard to step away from something when you're wrestling with it so hard, but that is often the best thing you can do.
Is there one thing that all artists have in common?
I think they all the people in this book anyway, have what you could call stubbornness – or what I'd like to call a passionate obstinacy. They have developed an ability to be so passionate about their work that even with the things that are thrown at them or people saying no, they are able to say, okay, I hear you, but I'm going to keep going anyway.
Does the financial component that is huge in the art world today make it less possible for artists to not be afraid if something crashes and fails? Because it's not even about this project. It's about getting work a year from now or 3 years from now.
Well, I hear you say that, and I think that's probably true for all of us in whatever job we have, because there's such fear right now in the world. And I think a key thing is to just look at that fear and say, yep, I see what that is, but I got to keep going, because otherwise, how do you create anything new? You can't let that fear stop you.
So we've talked about your radio producing. We've talked about your writing. Is speaking a third sort of totally different thing for you?
This is new. You know, I've done a lot of on-stage interviews, and I've produced a lot of live shows. So I know a little bit about that world, but I found preparing for this was a lot of fun, partly because I read the book like it was new, and suddenly I was seeing new things, new patterns in the stories that these artists were telling. And so for speaking, it's also lovely, because when you speak in public, it's a little different than speaking on the radio in that you can show things too.
Yeah.
So that's been a lot of fun, is thinking about how to use these voices and the images to be able to create an experience that'll be moving for someone sitting in the audience.
Julie Burstein is creator of PRI's Studio 360 and author of the new book Spark: How Creativity Works. She will speak tonight at the DMA for the Arts and Letters Live series. You can find information on the Think page of KERA.org. Julie, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.